How did you first come to know Woody Guthrie's music?
I was introduced to Woody Guthrie completely by accident. And I can be really specific because I had gotten a guitar for my 14th birthday and knew that this was an impossible expenditure for my family and that there was going to be no money either from them or from me to be able to afford lessons. So I thought, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll go down to the public library and I'll look up in the card catalog for guitar instruction. There's got to be something there. And the only thing that was under guitar was a book, a tattered black and white paperback book entitled Woody Guthrie Folk Songs. Now, I had no idea who Woody Guthrie was at age 14. And because the first page of that book was all those guitar chord grids, and all your listeners who play will know what I'm talking about. And it was followed by 50 or 60 songs. I thought, this is great. I've got songs I can learn with guitar chords that I can be taught. I can learn. How difficult can it be? And so probably the first 30 or 40 songs I learned were Woody Guthrie songs. And it was a big chunk of inspiration and information because he was one of our most ecumenical songwriters. He wrote kids' songs and love songs and historical songs and topical songs. And he wrote about everything for everybody. So he set the table for my approach to what I was going to do for my own music. So he was a quite accidental but absolutely essential influence on me.
How widely known was his music at that point in the 1960s?
I think if you were part of the folk music revival, you absolutely knew about it. But I was growing up in Wisconsin. I was far from the reaches of, you know, New York and Boston and San Francisco and places like that where it was a going concern. I thought I was the only one who knew anything about this, and I had no idea that there was elements of this in popular music. This was 1966. So yeah, the Beatles were there. It was a year shy of, you know, the guitar taking off with Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton and people like that. Country radio, to tell you the truth, I wasn't listening to a lot of country radio at that time. I was a typical, you know, American teenager listening to the latest tunes of the day, and Woody Guthrie and folk music had nothing at all to do with any of that. And Woody, in fact, was in a mental institution at that point. He had Huntington's chorea, which is a degenerative neurological disease, and he had been in this particular hospital for probably a dozen years by this time, and he died in 1967. So he did not figure in to popular music. I think people really didn't know who he was. I mean, it was because of this book that I learned he was the guy who wrote This Land of Is Your Land, because of course every school kid learns that song, but they never tell you who write these songs. So I don't think Woody figured into popular music really at all at that point.
What do you see as being the relationship between country music and folk music?
Well, I think there's two ways to look at it. There's one sort of the ethnographic way, the sort of scholarly way of looking at what is folk music, and it's something that comes out of people's lives and communities. It's done for totally unself-conscious purposes. There's often a community of people that depend on it. You know, that was the thing that drew me to and kept me in the Appalachian South, because this is where people who played fiddles and banjos and guitars and auto harps and stuff like that, they were essential parts of community life. So that's folk music in one sense. The other way to think about it is it's a branch of commercial music. And you had everybody from Peter, Paul, and Mary to Bob Dylan. You know, Simon and Garfunkel started off there. The Smothers Brothers, Judy Collins, Joan Baez, John Denver. All these people really started with this acoustic-based, lyrically-driven music that often told stories. It's the root of country music. I mean, folk music is the root of all music, really, before anything else, there was folk music, because it's just something that, go back to definition number one, that people had to do because it helped create and sustain communities. So yeah, that's where Woody Guthrie fit in. He was inspired by a guy named Joe Hill, who was a labor songwriter from the early 20th century, who just wrote utilitarian songs. You know, you'd write for this group, about this thing, for this group of people. It was not, you know, you were not writing for the ages. You were writing so that the song did a job and pulled its shift and then went home. It wasn't for money or grandeur or notoriety or anything.
So what do you think Woody's music specifically has in common with country music?
Well, he wrote really straightforward story songs. And he wrote about things that seemed to be poo-pooed by the recording and media elite of the time. I mean, country music only became popular by sheer accident. I mean, if the very first million-dollar seller from any genre was Fiddling John Carson, who was a street performer in Atlanta, and recorded a couple of sides, and they went wild. And, you know, the music business is a business first and foremost. It's not about music, it's about money. And so when they saw, oh, there's all these people who like this kind of music, we'll put out music for them and they'll buy it. And early on, you had Jimmy Rogers, you had the Carter family, you know, you had Vernon Dalhart, you had Uncle Dave Macon, and lots of amazing musicians that really were folk musicians. But they laid a framework for drawing in an audience that wanted that kind of music. And then from there, it's, you know, the most narrative-driven music on popular radio today is country music, and it's a direct descendant of folk music.
Can you talk about Woody's connection to politics and how he informed his music?
I think that most musicians are going to take inspiration from wherever they can get it. Woody's music was ubiquitous among a folk music audience, and even though somebody like a Johnny Cash or a Dolly Parton can become incredibly popular in a certain wing of country music, you know, I knew Johnny, and he loved just to play with a guitar and sing old songs, sing new songs. You know, Johnny took great risks. He had Pete Seeger. He's the person who broke the blacklist on Pete Seeger by having him on the Johnny Cash show. You know, and I can't help but think that the kind of courage exhibited by Woody, by Pete, by Johnny Cash, didn't have an effect on all kinds of musicians. So who got their inspiration from whom? I don't know. I mean, one of the things I thought about when we first talked about having this call was Gene Autry's huge hit, The Death of Mother Jones, who was a radical agitator for unions in the early part of the 20th century. And he had a huge hit on what was then country radio, a lot less prescribed than it is now, with this song about the death of, you know, the miner's angel, Mother Jones. So go figure. Uncle Dave Macon wrote pro-union songs. So, you know, there have always been these concerns that used to be connected with a certain class and commerce of people. And people used to write and sing about them. I think a lot of people are just scared now. I mean, look what happened to the Dixie Chicks. I don't want that to happen to me.
I think people often forget about Johnny Cash's politics. The Ballad of Ira Hayes and the album Bitter Tears which was really about the struggle of Native Americans at the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Johnny was a really, really interesting guy. I got to know him because I was living in Scott County, Virginia, which is the home of the Carter family. And he would every once in a while come to the Carter Family Festival, and I played there every year. And got to know him in the not only the last years of his life, but in the 1970s. And he was a very daring kind of guy. But, you know, there's a whole nother world of country music out there that it's, you know, realistically speaking, you're not hearing a lot of Loretta Lynn on the radio these days. You're not hearing a lot of Dolly Parton on that. You don't hear Willie Nelson. You don't hear Johnny Cash on the radio. But there's a whole new crowd of very, I mean, Jason Isbell, I think, is one of the most interesting writers and performers out there today. So it's a really, really broad kind of music that, if you're not paying attention, you don't know that, you know, that there's, it's got many facets.
Do you think that a person's politics can detract listeners?
Well, and I think frankly, the opposite is true as well. There's a lot of people who Woody wrote over 3,500 songs. And I can tell you as a songwriter, you write a lot of crap. And so sometimes you can be forgiven a lot because people like your politics. But your point is well taken. And I think it's really important to look at the context in which someone's politics develop. Woody was raised at a time when Oklahoma was hit with the 1-2 punch of the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl storms of the 1930s. He, like many people in Oklahoma and Kansas and Arkansas, lots of places, were driven out of their homes. They became unsustainable. You could not farm the land, and ended up going out to the migrant labor camps of the California Central Valley. And people were trying to make sense of how to get out of what got us all into the situation of the Great Depression and how to get out of it. And some of the solutions that were offered, which, came from some pretty far out left-wing areas. And the Communist Party was a going concern in the United States at that particular time, because some people felt it offered an analysis that made sense. And Woody was never a member of the Communist Party, though he wrote for the Daily Worker because they asked him to. And he had, you know, pretty populist attitudes. His politics were hard won. And I grew up as a young 20-year-old kid traveling around the Appalachian South and hanging out with people who'd grown up in coal camps and had been beaten by the Pinkertons and had been burned out of their homes when they tried to organize unions. And so these were people who didn't have a Marxist professor at college. They earned their politics by life experience, and we're looking for ways to make sense of the world. So that's how Woody developed his politics. And if you look at it through a 2019 lens, it can seem kind of anachronistic. A lot of stuff has happened in the last 100 years. The experiments in communism have been a disaster from one end of the world to the other. But a lot of the things that we've adopted in this country, Social Security, Medicare, highways, armies, public schools, libraries, are all products of the government providing services. So, you know, nothing is pure, and nothing is worth accepting or denying without asking questions.
Do you think Woody's politics have kept him out of the Country Music Hall of Fame?
Before our call, anticipating this question, I actually went to the Country Music Hall of Fame website, and I only got through the H's because the members of the Hall of Fame were listed alphabetically. But to me, having a decent knowledge of the history of country music, it is hewed pretty close to what people understand as the history of country music. It doesn't go very far afield. You don't have people who dabbled in country music. You don't have the occasional rock star, like, you know, in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Hell, you have Pete Seeger. And you have people who, you know, Joan Baez is on the ballot this year, or was inducted last year. I can't remember. So I think that the other kinds of other halls of fame, Songwriters Hall of Fame, Country Music, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Folk Music Hall of Fame, etc., have much broader criteria. In just looking at what has been in there, it doesn't surprise me that he's not there, because he never trafficked in the world of commercial country music, even in its earliest days. He certainly influenced. Should he be there? Absolutely. He was foundational to American music. Does it surprise me he's not? Unfortunately, no. Was it his politics? You know, I don't necessarily think so. I think that they have a very narrow eye of the needle through which they look. At least that's what the current members that I see tell me.
One of the most moving songs I think that Woody Guthrie wrote is one that you covered, Deportees' Plane Wreck at Los Gatos.
I get a lot of requests to sing that song these days. Of course, I recorded it, and I was also I've been involved in the sort of the coda of the whole story. For the benefit of your listeners, there was a plane that took off from near San Jose on January 28th, 1948. And on that plane were 28 Mexican agricultural workers who had all been in the United States legally under the Bracero program. And their work visas had run out, and they were being transported to a relocation camp in El Centro, California, for the purposes of processing them for deportation. And of course, probably immediately turning around, signing up for the Bracero program again, and coming back. The plane developed engine trouble shortly after takeoff and went down in the Los Gatos Creek Canyon just outside of Coalinga, California, which is about an hour west of Fresno. And everybody on there was lost. There were a pilot, a co-pilot, a flight attendant, and what today would be called an ICE worker, an INS worker. And the following day, the New York Times, among others, carried the story, and they went to great lengths to list the names of the pilot, co-pilot, flight attendant, and INS agent, and then concluded by saying also on board were 28 Mexican nationals who were being processed for deportation. Woody was one of, you know, tens and maybe hundreds of thousands of people who read that story. And Woody was outraged that these people were not given names. Now, as a sidebar, one of his most well-known songs is the Reuben James, about the sinking of a World War II ship, where I think 76 people were lost, or some great number of soldiers were lost, and he wrote a song naming every single one of those soldiers. And names are important to Woody. And so he wrote this song. Now understand, this is 1948. He was a couple of years away from institutionalization. And many historians say this was the last great song that he wrote. There's debate about that, but I have heard that. And he never put a melody to it. Years later, a folk singer named Hoffman put a melody to it, and that's the melody that we know today. After I recorded the song, I got very interested in this kind of folk music mystery story. And before I played in Fresno, the year that the album came out, I did some research, knowing that this was the nearest town I was playing to the crash site, and discovered that these people were buried in the Holy Cross Cemetery in Fresno. So I went there to the cemetery and found the grave. It was easy to find a place that had room for 28 bodies and one small headstone. And talked to the director of the cemetery, and he said, yeah, this is weird. And we went on the internet and found the names. And there was a fellow by the name of Tim Hernandez who had done a great deal more research on this and not only found the corrected list of names, but found the families. And about 3 or 4 years later, I was honored to be a part of an event that laid a memorial with all the names at the grave site. This is all to say that one of the things Woody did is he wrote about stories from our past, current events. And this was a case in which he kept this story alive for 65 years and allowed different people to work together to solve this mystery so that the people were not only called deportees. It's what music does, is what Woody does. He humanized a situation so they weren't just statistics or nameless characters, but you cared about them. You wanted to know more. And that's one of the great things that Woody did with his music. He made you ask questions. He made you question the things that you thought you knew and to not accept anything less than the truth.